classical and regional myths and the more interesting parts of the Bible. Newbery saw an opportunity and took it. He started producing volumes like A Little Pretty Pocketbook. This, published in 1744, is generally held up as the first proper children's book, to be read for enjoyment, not under duress for the good of your immortal soul. It cost sixpence, and for tuppence extra, the infant owner got a toy with it, a red and black ball or pincushion for boys and girls, respectively. The publishers of Sugar Pink Rose are not yet around to object. And with them, they could record the day's progress, adding a pin to the red side for the instances of good behaviour, to the black for bad. The sequel was called A Little Pretty Pocketbook Identifying the Symptoms of Blood Poisoning Arising from the Conjunction of Dirty Pins and Imprecise Wieldings Thereof by Tiny Hands. Though not really. But I imagine it would have sold well. The book itself contained letters from Jack the Giant Killer exhorting Little Master Tommy and Little Miss Polly to be good, and poems about common children's games, followed by a moral extracted, often very dubiously, from each. Baseball, the first documented use of the word, incidentally, though it's being used to refer to modern baseball's ancestor, rounders, runs, "The ball once struck off, away flies the boy, to the next destined post, then home with joy." Moral, "Thus seamen for lucre fly over the main, but with pleasure, transported, return back again." Still more fun than reading about dying orphans, okay? Context is all. By the second half of the 18th century, religious tracts had developed into the more narratively coherent and compelling moral tales that would eventually give rise to the reward book industry. Written mostly by women, the first of these is generally thought to be Sarah Fielding's The Governess, in which various students are encouraged to identify and reflect on their individual flaws and all pledge to do better on the morrow. The aim of such tales was to train the childish mind out of frivolity and into sober adult ways, an aim which reaches its apogee in a book called Fabulous Histories, later History of the Robins, about being kind to animals, by one of the most redoubtable, prolific, and dogmatic of the moralists, Mrs. Trimmer. Having given in, despite the era's and genre's fear of the power of fiction to corrupt, to the temptation of writing a book about talking birds, she goes to great lengths to strike preemptively against all possible harm. Readers should consider the tales not as containing the real conversations of birds, for that it is impossible we should ever understand, and her fables are designed not merely to excite compassion and tenderness for those interesting and delightful creatures on which such wanton cruelties are frequently exercised, but also to convey moral instruction to the young reader, and in particular to recommend the practice of general benevolence. Are we all quite clear? Good. Then let the story, at last, commence. There are footnotes along the way to keep you from straying from the path of righteousness. "The mockbird is properly a native of America," reads one, "but is introduced here for the sake of the moral." Duly noted, Mrs. T. Over the course of the century after The Governess first appeared, the bonds of propriety loosened, fiction ceased to be quite such a dread force in the minds of the good lady writers, and they gradually allowed the tale, rather than the moral, to come to the fore. In 1818, the first of three volumes of The History of the Fairchild Family, The Child's Manual, being a collection of stories calculated to show the importance and effects of a religious education, was published, replete with dying children gloriously redeemed, slash emphatically not, in their final hours, depending how godly their tiny lives had been until then. Further volumes followed in 1842 and 1847, with a notable softening of attitudes each time. This alteration in children's fare was partly because religious attitudes became a bit less blood and thundery, partly because of the sheer weight of social change. The first half of the 19th century brought with it compulsory education for children and the invention of mass manufacturing, which meant books could be produced relatively cheaply for the first time. Now, suddenly, there was a market of 3 million newly literate, story-hungry children to cater for, and catered for they certainly were. The fanciful and fantastic were increasingly welcomed, and fairy tales, which for a long time had been judged the greatest possible pollutant of innocent, impressionable minds, were fully welcomed into the fold, in both their traditional forms and in new, such as Ruskin's The King of the Golden River. Charles and Mary Lamb wrote tales from Shakespeare for young readers, and Catherine Sinclair even let the children in her 1839 tale Holiday House be unequivocally naughty without being eternally damned. Good times! By the middle of the century, the fashion had moved from strictly virtuous exhortations to stories about virtuous or learning to be virtuous children. And within another few decades, the market and notions of acceptability had broadened further to include historical fiction and, for boys especially, adventure stories, and relatively secular melodramatic tales, albeit with an improving moral in there somewhere. It was to this later school that Sam Sylvan's sacrifice belonged. It had also belonged to my dad. Inside the flyleaf was written, "For Richard, see how long you keep it nice, Granny Mangan." I was speechless. It was old enough, Dad pointed out, for her to have owned it before she passed it on to him, just as Nanny was now passing it on to me. I was holding history in my hands. Real history, family history, in my hands. The flyleaf message was covered in crayon. "Did you do that?" I asked Dad. He nodded. I was awed and appalled in equal measure. It gave me a new measure of the man. My quiet, gentle dad, a born recidivist. I'm reeling still. Sam Sylvan's sacrifice was my first exposure to untrammelled Victorian melodrama. It's quite a thing, you know. The two fatherless boys are Sam and his younger brother Fred. Fred is selfish. Fred is selfish, greedy, thoughtless, and always being hauled out of scrapes or given extra crusts of bread or having his general mess cleared up by the ever-generous, noble, selfless Sam. Fred is, frankly, appalling. Eventually, we reach the climactic set piece of our morality tale. Fred's ineluctable Fredness has landed them in a field with a snorting, maddened bull. The bull turns on them. The bull runs towards them. The boys run towards the high wall around the field. There is only time for one of them to boost the other one over. This, I knew, would be the moment when all that Sam had done for him over the years would suddenly overwhelm Fred, and he would choose to boost his brother over the wall to make up for a lifetime of sin. I don't know what part of Sam Sylvan's sacrifice I didn't understand. Because, of course, the Victorians being what they were, Fred has no such epiphany. He gladly accepts Sam's shove over the wall and then looks down in horror as his saintly brother is gored to death below him. He sure feels bad then. But it's too late. I mean, like, really too late. Because Sam's dead. Completely dead. I really cannot convey to you how dead he is. The finality of it was terrible. I didn't grieve for Sam. You're dead, I reckoned, and the keen edge of my compassion for him and his innards was further dulled by the slight contempt in which I continue to hold all pushovers and softies. But the contemplation of the infinite punishment Fred's now awoken conscience had in store for him held me completely in its thrall. My own conscience was an overactive organ that had already colonized large parts of my mind and was pursuing the rest relentlessly. And my own sins, I knew at least in the rational part of my mind, were small. But what would it be like to live with something so awful pressing down on you, such guilt abrading your very soul? I shrank in horror from the idea, and yet could not resist tiptoeing round it, trying at least to gauge the size and shape of such a burden. Fred and Sam, you live in me still. Every time I think of taking the easy route out of a difficulty, or am tempted to let someone else deal with the consequences of some stupid thing I've set in motion. Well played, Victorian moralists, Granny Mangan and Nanny. Well played. My other grandmother, Mum's mum, known as Grandma, was equally great. She was born and bred in Edinburgh, but moved to Lancashire when she got married and gave birth to a child every year or so there until her husband, David, contracted rheumatic fever when serving as a naval doctor in the war and died. "Good job," my Auntie Nancy, looking at the five children under seven, told her. When we went to stay with her, which we did at least three times a year, she fed us Hawaiian sandwiches, club biscuits and wine gums without surcease, and when Mum tried to object, she would say, "For heaven's sake, Christine, they're on the holidays." It was the only time I ever saw my mother cede any kind of ground. When Grandma came to stay with us, which she did at least three times a year, she would sneak us toffees in between playing Bobby Shafto and "Soldier, Soldier, Won't You Marry Me" on the piano 800 times a day for us, while we marched up and down the carpet pretending to be silver-buckled sailors and treacherous soldiers. And as soon as my parents left for work in the evening, we would play pontoon and three-card brag for pennies and tuppences until pleasingly far past bedtime. She would bet on a six high, just to make a game of it. You would not have known from her cavalier attitude to her rapidly diminishing purse full of coppers that this was a woman who came fifth in the National Civil Service exams in 1930-something and knew the entirety of Scottish history like the back of her hand. Whenever she left to go home, it was an occasion of much lamenting on our parts. So she started leaving a wee present for each of us in the top drawer of the chest on the landing. We would say goodbye to her in the morning before we went to school, but have the thought of the gift to distract us from finding her gone when we came home. One day, after Grandma had done her disappearing act, Emily and I rushed upstairs to open the drawer. a box, an entire box, not a plastic packet, of Maltesers for her, and for me, something even more incredible, the most gorgeous book I had ever seen. She would give me many over the years, from Josephine Tay's Brat Farah to George Eliot's Silas Marner, and I will regret forever that she died before I discovered my own liking for the Waverley novels, which she loved with a passion befitting a Caledonian expat, but this was by far the most beautiful. A hardback, bound in red leather, with gold curlicues all over it, and inside were onion-skin pages covered in an attractively quaint font. The title, on the spine of the book only, not on the front cover, lest it interrupt all those gold curlicues, promised they would tell the story of Little Women. It would prove to be a great story when I got to it, but there was much to detain me first. Beautiful end papers, those flourishes repeated in a duller gold on a chocolate-brown background, gave way to a strange thing called Biography of the Author, one Louisa May Alcott apparently, which lasted 3.5 pages and was almost as good as a story. In fact, it was such a heavily bowdlerized version of the author's life that it did almost amount to a story. According to this brief outline, the Alcott family were as gently and picturesquely impoverished as the Marches and almost as content. It glosses almost entirely over the fact that Louisa's father, Amos Bronson Alcott, was a relentless narcissist who put his family through hell with his commitment to his transcendental ideals and who had a messiah complex that precluded him from ever doing a proper day's work and providing for his growing family. In 1840, he abandoned the little school he had set up in order to preach and write full-time. This was about as bad an idea then as it would be now. "I wait not for the arithmetic of the matter," he cried, the sentiment of the incurably selfish everywhere, and it marked the last time he would ever bring in a regular wage. He never liked Louisa very much. She was too outgoing, impulsive, and opinionated. He called her and his wife Abba my two demons, and much preferred his docile oldest daughter Anna, who would often greet him at the door with a list of her sins and ask forgiveness. I know. Unpick that at your leisure. It was his two demons, however, who kept the family afloat via their various labours, though they both became, understandably, embittered by the process over the years. And it was the success of Little Women in 1868 that finally brought them some true financial relief, and Louisa a measure of personal freedom. Or, as my copy's biography puts it, henceforth she was her own master, able to live where she liked and the way she liked, and, this had always been one of her fondest dreams, minister to the well-being of her family. Okay. After those pagefuls of factoids, there was an even stranger thing called an introduction, which was about the book itself. I skipped that. Why would I read about the book when the actual book was there, waiting to be read just a few pages on? And what a book it was. In the story of the March family grappling with genteel New England poverty and finding ways to keep themselves happy and busy while their beloved father is away fighting in the war, there is something, and someone, for everyone. Stay-at-home types can take comfort in Meg's story. She is the eldest sister and therefore terribly sensible, except for one never-to-be-forgotten chapter, when she throws caution and New England puritanism to the wind and gets her shoulders out for the lads at a ball. An evening of wild champagne sipping and fan-waving are enough fun for one lifetime, however, and she is then able to settle down happily with John Brooke and a linen cupboard. I had and still have a lot of time for Meg. I too would discover once adolescence hit in a few years' time that one evening's excitement was enough and retire from the fray thereafter. In my case, it was not at a ball, but a grimy nightclub in New Cross, southeast London, called The Venue. It was too loud to talk and there was nowhere to sit except for the filthy floor. You were supposed to be up and dancing, of course, but I mimed a resounding no to that. And a single drink cost twice what I was earning an hour at the local supermarket, and everything was awful. I sat, gingerly, in a corner, and thought fondly of linen cupboards until it was time to go home. For readers of a less hermetic stripe, there's Amy, an admirably proto-modern girl who has to be beaten over the head with the family copy of The Pilgrim's Progress before she can remember to pretend that people are more important than money, and that her Aunt March's rosary is not, in fact, simply a statement necklace. Attagirl. Romantics can have Beth, and even from my very first reading, were welcome to her. I was profoundly perplexed when a family friend saw what I was reading and asked if I had cried at her deathbed scene. It did not even occur to me to mourn the passing of such a relentlessly angelic, bloodless nothing, a lack of feeling the years have done nothing since to remedy. Tomboys, of course, have, once you've made allowances for various 19th-century handicaps, a glorious heroine in Jo. From her, they learn that they can make money in unfeminine ways such as writing, as long as they A, spend their hard-earned cash on sending careworn Marmee to the seaside, and B, eventually stop it to marry ancient German men with beards and open orphanages for boys in none too subtle exercises in wish fulfilment. Writers-to-be loved Jo perhaps even more passionately. She was the character Louisa May based most directly on herself. The others were idealized portraits of her own sisters and parents. And her longing to write and the fulfillment she finds in doing so provide the most vivid moments in an already vivid book. Her description of Jo falling into a vortex and giving herself up to scribbling in the attic for as long as the story held her thrilled me to the marrow. It was with great sadness I learned years later that the writing of Little Women itself rarely gave the author that vertiginous feeling of exhilaration. She enjoyed writing the gothic romances that had made her name, her first was published in 1854, and the more lurid tales she published pseudonymously in the 1860s, because they offered her an escape from what was, by and large, quite a hardscrabble and miserable life. But Little Women was based on her real life, and written at the behest of others. Her father thought there should be more good, plain, morally uplifting stories for boys and girls, and her publishers wanted a girl's book from her, so she found it more of a slog. As she put it in her diary, "I plod away, though I don't enjoy this sort of thing. Never liked girls or knew many except my sisters. But our queer plays and experiences may prove interesting, though I doubt it." Her publisher doubted it too when she sent him the first dozen chapters. He found them dull. But by the time the first proof of the whole book was done, both he and the author were more impressed. "It reads better than I expected," Louisa's diary records. "Not a bit sensational, but simple and true, for we really lived most of it. And if it succeeds, that will be the reason of it. Some girls who have read the manuscript say it is splendid. As it is for them, they are the best critics, so I should be satisfied." Those early readers were an accurate bellwether. Little Women was an instant bestseller and has been loved by generations of, mostly, girls ever since. Gilbert Keith Chesterton was a fan, however, admiring Little Women's realism, and likened Alcott's work to Jane Austen's, but said he felt like a male intruder on its grounds. The March sisters' adventures remain as fresh and Moorish as the muffins that greet them when they wake on Christmas Day, and as satisfying. Their little universe is a well-ordered one. Sins are always expiated, sacrifices always rewarded, with spiritual growth, not money or extra limes or anything. That would kind of negate the whole concept. And so is kindness. Let someone use your neglected piano, and a pair of bespoke embroidered slippers will soon be yours. Justice is always done, at least according to the 1868 lights of a woman working through some fairly major daddy and transcendental theology issues. I was fine with Beth going to her reward, but I thought Jo letting Amy plunge through the ice and nearly drown was entirely fair compensation for Amy throwing her manuscript on the fire. No need for Jo to sob for forgiveness afterwards. She would have been well within her rights to let her drown, I thought. And I stand, as the anxious guardian of my own manuscript here, even more firmly by this today. I also remain undecided about the whole Jo, Laurie, Amy, Professor Bear imbroglio. Between the publication of the first part of Little Women and the publication a year later in 1869 of the second, known as Good Wives, readers begged Alcott to have Jo marry rich boy next door, Laurie, who befriends the whole family, but Jo in particular. They were out of luck. This was, after all, a woman who once lauded spinsterhood in an article entitled Happy Women, on the grounds that liberty is a better husband than love to many of us, which is 19th century feminist speak for, have you seen the state of most of them? Jesus. Her diary entry for the 1st of November reads, "Began the second part of Little Women. Girls write to ask who the little women marry, as if that was the only end and aim of a woman's life. I won't marry Jo to Laurie to please anyone." Perhaps if the pressure from her public and her publisher hadn't been quite so great, she would have let Jo go unmarried entirely. As it was, she at least resisted the easy option and invented the professor instead. He has no real ancestor in juvenile fiction. He was created especially for Jo. She meets the Berliner, neither rich nor great, young nor handsome, in no respect what is called fascinating, imposing or brilliant, and yet he was as attractive as a genial fire, and people seemed to gather about him as naturally as about a warm hearth. After she has turned down Laurie's proposal of marriage and gone to New York City to write and teach, they form a friendship that deepens gradually and diffidently into love. They marry, and once Aunt March dies, turn her huge home and grounds into a boy's orphanage. Yes, there are shades of Louisa's father in idealized form in there. Teacher who sticks at it, an older bearded man who puts his orphanage-wide family and his wife before everything and can be relied on at all times. But he is right for her. and more of a man than Laurie will ever be, I'm telling you. Look, I liked Laurie, okay? He was fine. He just... Well, he wasn't much, was he? He was too light and bright when he wasn't being spoiled and sulky for Joe. He was a much better fit for Amy. They could waft around Europe insubstantially together. Joe needed something more stolid altogether. So yes, I'm a Bearite. I rate the prof. I've had many arguments about this over the years. Not as numerous as those I've had about Anne of Green Gables. Sickening or charming beyond measure, we will get to this. But still, many. Those not on Team Bear find him smug, patronising, and, as a friend once shrieked at me in a moment of particularly high emotion, he kills her dreams! Because she ends up running a school at which he can teach instead of carrying on writing for a living. I still do not see it. I just think he's wonderful. And she wants to run that school. She's just lucky she fell in love with a man who can also teach. It's all good. Whatever your view of particular events or characters in the book, taken all together, what Little Women does is give the reader a picture of four different girls and a marmy, working to cultivate, subdue and repress various aspects of themselves to fit a preordained model of femininity, which leads you to the very dimmest beginnings of a shred of a scintilla of awareness that there is a model, and that that's a bit mental. Elizabeth Janeway wrote in a New York Times book review in 1968 that Little Women was written by a secret rebel against the order of the world and women's place in it, and all the girls who've ever read it know it. It gave me another link in a chain of thought I was not quite consciously developing. I tucked the Marches in beside Ramona and felt able to set my face a little more firmly against twirly girls at school, who at 8 going on 9 were growing twirlier by the bloody day. Classics. Little Women had another welcome effect too. It introduced me to the hitherto unknown world of the classic. I wanted to know why this book had had so much effort put into it. The red leather, the gilding, the very, very thin, very, very white paper, the introduction and biography. It seemed to fall under the heading of material rather than philosophical conundrums, so instead of running to my usual fount of book wisdom, I presented it to my own Marmy for consideration. It was an old book, she explained. But Grandma had only just given it to me, I pointed out. No, not in that sense, she said. In the sense that it had been written a long time ago and been printed and reprinted ever since because people kept wanting to read it. It was considered a classic. There were lots of them, books that had endured and which everyone had either read or at least heard so much about that they had absorbed the essence of them almost by osmosis. What was osmosis? I asked. But she had run out of time for explanations. I think the house needed repointing before our swimming lesson or something, so I spoke to empty air. No matter. The next time Dad took me to Dillon's in Bromley, I scanned the shelves until I found the title Little Women. It was part of a series which all had similar covers, the Puffin Classics livery. Over the next few months, Dad would add many volumes to my shelf at home. I weeded out first anything too adventurous, Treasure Island, Journey to the Centre of the Earth, Coral Island, and so on, and second, all the animal stories. I had an early, strict and enduring rule against books in which animals, especially talking animals, were the predominant feature. Thus the oblivion to which I had already consigned Beatrix Potter, Winnie the Pooh, the inhabitants of Bramley Hedge, rabbits Peter and Brer, and Tales of Farthing Wood, I now added, with an equal lack of compunction, the likes of the Just So stories and the Wind in the Willows. What an idiot. I don't know where or when this mindless prejudice was formed, but in the coming years it would also set me against classics like Tarka the Otter and Ring of Bright Water and the Whitbread Award-winning The Song of Pentecost and countless less famous others. What? An idiot. Never mind. What's done is done. And even after a purge of fur and feathers, there was still a fair portion of the canon to devour. I set to work with a will. The canon, for children, generally means books written between roughly the late Victorian era and the end of the Edwardian age, products of what's traditionally been considered the golden age of children's literature, bookended by Alice in Wonderland, 1865, and Winnie the Pooh, 1920. Any later and you're into upstart modern classics territory. Any earlier and you're back in moral tale territory and a world too different for its stories to have endured. But by the middle of the century, as we've noted, entertainment had largely supplanted education as the driving force in children's books. Most of the categories and genres, including adventure, school and family stories, into which children's books still fall today, had been established, and the machinery for producing, bountifully illustrating and distributing writers' wares was becoming ever more smooth and sophisticated. Authors could make decent livings writing for children, which attracted more and more contributors, good and bad, to the field. Still, they hadn't quite managed to shuck off the last vestige of the moral tale, the tendency to talk as an adult slightly down to children. A faintly pedagogic tone and a teacherly distance remained between the author and his or her reader. And then came Alice. Chapter 7. Wonderlands. Many a day we rode together on that quiet stream, the three little maidens and I, and many a fairy tale had been extemporized for their benefit. Yet none of these tales got written down. They lived and died like summer midges, each in its own golden afternoon, until there came a day when, as it chanced, one of my little listeners petitioned that the tale might be written out for her. In a desperate attempt to strike out some new line in fairy lore, I had sent my heroine straight down a rabbit hole to begin with, without the least idea what was going to happen afterwards. Quiet stream is the Thames in 1860-something. The tale-teller is the Reverend Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, and the petitioning maiden is Alice Liddell. The tale itself became known as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which Dodgson, not wishing to damage his scholarly reputation as a mathematician at Oxford, published under the nom de plume Lewis Carroll. I didn't read it when I was a child, though it has been so thoroughly embedded in the national psyche since it first sold out on publication that for years I believed I had. That, of course, being Alan Bennett's famous definition of a classic, a book everyone is assumed to have read and often thinks they have. It wasn't until I started reading it to Alexander last year that although I knew about the white rabbit, the bottle labelled Drink Me, the cake labelled Eat Me, the growing and shrinking, the encounters with the hooker-smoking caterpillar, Cheshire Cat and its grin, the Mad Hatter, tea parties and croquet with the Queen of Hearts with flamingos for mallets and hedgehogs for balls, and the frankly rigged trial of the Knave of Hearts who stole some tarts, I hadn't actually experienced them firsthand. I had just absorbed the basics through the ether. And what I hadn't appreciated from a distance was the very thing that makes Alice such a landmark in children's literary history. The directness of Carroll's voice, the alternating stoicism and stroppiness of his protagonist, who completely steps outside the hitherto unbroken tradition of polite, delicate, submissive heroines, as she navigates her way through this world of irrational creatures, mad royals, and untrustworthy labels on attractive foodstuffs. The all-pervading sense of a writer at one with his child self instead of writing down to a half-remembered state, the sheer modernity of it all. Also, it's an absolute rush, a delicious, borderline hallucinatory confection. Alice is a riot of nonsense, parodies, wordplay, twisted and dreamlike, logic, illogic, invention and imagination tumbling over each other in the excitement. There's something in there for everyone. I like the semantic shenanigans, the mouse giving a very dry lecture on William the Conqueror to restore those who have been soaked by Alice's gigantic tears pleases me most, while Alexander is as yet more entranced by the cat that leaves its grin behind. I do wonder what the mother of a more mathematically inclined friend of mine thought when her son's interest snagged on the eat me and drink me scenes because, he recalls delightedly now, they introduced me to the concept of absolute scale. She was probably used to operating at a certain level of bewilderment by then. It reads completely differently from everything that came before it. There is no question that it is meant purely to entertain and to entertain unstoppably. A stream of nonsense, in the best possible sense, designed to carry every reader away. Way to inaugurate a golden age, Mr. C. Thanks. Frances Hodgson Burnett. Although I miss out on Alice, my actual introduction to the Edwardian classics was an absolute belter. The writer and critic Margarita Lasky once said that she had loved it because it was a book for introspective town children. As one of that happy, if pallid, breed, I can confirm that she was absolutely right. It was The Secret Garden, and it had absolutely everything you could possibly want in a story. An admirably sour-faced orphan, Mary Lennox, whose parents die when cholera sweeps through their home in India. A country house, Misselthwaite Manor, to which Mary is sent to live with her even more sour-faced uncle, who is still mourning the death of his wife. An invalid boy, her cousin Colin, who has a non-specific spinal problem and is the source of the mournful cries that have been keeping Mary up at night and improving her temper not at all. A secret garden, the key to which Mary discovers as she begins to warm to and explore Misselthwaite Manor. And finally, a proto-sex god called Dickon, brother of the manor's friendly maid, Martha Sowerby, who knows all about gardening and how to roast eggs in a tree hollow. Together in the peaceful privacy of the garden, they bring hope, Mary's tender side, and Colin's legs back to life. Who could ask for anything more? Judging by its relative lack of success on publication, the answer seemed to be quite a lot of people. Little Lord Fauntleroy, Francis Hodgson Burnett's first children's story, about Cedric Errol, a poor little boy in New York, who turns out to be an English earl, a rags-to-riches story that echoed Francis's own and was a plot she used many times in her adult and children's fiction, had been a critical and commercial triumph. Adults in particular loved it, and a generation of young boys were forced into velvet suits, lace collars, and curl papers until their fond mamas emerged from their collective passion to ape the sartorial fashions of the eponymous hero. The mob-capped shades of Kate Greenaway's generation must have hovered round and laughed. The Little Lord himself, to be fair, is far less nauseating in the book than in the various screen adaptations that have come to dominate our memories of him. But the clothes were always terrible. They, and the accompanying long curled hairstyles, were based on those Hodgson Burnett herself created for her own two sons. All great women have their blind spots. And she was an amazing woman. She was born into a well-to-do family in Manchester in 1849, but when her father died of a stroke in 1853, they began a descent into poverty that, despite her mother's stakhanovite efforts to keep the family ironmongery business going, eventually forced them to emigrate to America in 1865. A rather incongruous fact, considering how firmly associated she is with the quintessential Englishness embodied in The Secret Garden, but fact it be. At 16, Frances arrived in Knoxville, Tennessee, and would not even visit England for the next 22 years. It was all hands to the pump in the New World, or in Frances's case, to the pen. She had always loved making up and enacting stories as a child, and so she began writing for some magazines. She was soon a frequent contributor to the prestigious likes of Godey's Ladies Book, the magazine pored over by the Ingalls women in the Little House on the Prairie books, Harper's Bazaar, and Scribner's Monthly. In 1873, she married Swan Burnett, a doctor whose medical training she paid for, and whom she would out-earn with the success of what she called her potboilers ever after. A few years later, she published a full-length book set in Lancashire, That Lass o' Lowrie's. Still a good read, if that can court wi' excruciating phonetic rendering of characters' dialogue. And began to build a reputation as a romantic novelist. In 1879, she went to Boston and met Louisa May Alcott and Mabel Mapes Dodge, the editor of children's magazine St. Nicholas, which inspired her to try her hand at children's fiction. Little Lord Fauntleroy began as a serial in Dodge's esteemed organ in 1894. Years of prolific writing for adults, extravagant living, and, once income allowed, annual trips back to Blighty followed, interspersed with periods of exhaustion from overwork, struggles with depression, and recuperation. In 1890, her beloved oldest son, Lionel, died of tuberculosis, a loss from which she never really recovered. Amongst other things, it caused her to retreat from her Anglican faith and look for solace in spiritualism and Christian Science. She and Swan unofficially separated and would divorce in 1898. She kept on their house in Washington, D.C., but gradually moved herself back to England, though she continued making trips back across the Atlantic to stay in touch with her other son, Vivian, who is now at Harvard and inconspicuously dressed. In England, she made her home at Great Maytham Hall, which was exactly what it sounds like, a huge, beautiful country house in Kent, whose large grounds included several lovely, peaceful walled and rose gardens in which Frances could write. And, in between remarrying a wrong'un called Stephen Townsend, who was basically only after her money, and divorcing again, she did. Her adult readers got several novels, and in 1905 it was the children's turn. She gave them A Little Princess, an expanded version of a story that she had written a few years before for St. Nicholas, called Sarah Crewe, or What Happened at Miss Minchin's. I didn't come to A Little Princess until after The Secret Garden, but I loved it almost as much. It's a much simpler story in content and execution. Sarah is the beloved only child of her widowed father, who enrolls her at Miss Minchin's boarding school for young ladies so that she can acquire some education and polish while he goes off to acquire some diamond mines and polish his fortune. Can you see where this is going yet? It's great, isn't it? Sure enough, father loses his fortune and his life out in diamond mine country, and Sarah is left a pauper. From being fated by the awful Miss Minchin and her equally awful pupils, Sarah is suddenly cast out. Miss Minchin banishes her to the attic and makes her work as a servant. Oh, the glorious horror of it all. But Miss Minchin has reckoned without Sarah's fortitude and imaginative resources. She pretends that she is a princess disguised as a servant, or sometimes a prisoner in the Bastille, And this, together with her friendship with Becky, a real servant girl with the lumpen lower-class face and nervy manner to prove it, and the mouse in her garret, gets her through her cold and unloved days. After many trials and tribulations, and one incredible sequence that pierces me still with the same degree of exquisite agony now as it did when I first read it over 30 years ago, in which starving Sarah finds a sixpence in the slush-filled gutter one bitter winter's day, buys 12 buns, and ends up giving them all, one by painful one, to a beggar girl in the street. She is hungrier than I. Justice is done. Mr. Crewe's friend, complete with her father's lost fortune, which was not so lost after all, turns up to rescue her, and Becky becomes Sarah's personal maid, because this is justice, sure, but 1905 style. I will be honest. You can come to A Little Princess in a mood that will lead you to find it faintly sickening. The legacy of the Victorian love of sentiment regarding childhood is sometimes too plain to see. The testing of Sarah's magnanimity and patience is constant, and her saintliness sometimes verges on the absurd. The baker who watches Sarah give away all her buns is so uplifted by her example that she employs the beggar girl as her assistant on the spot, for heaven's sake. And yet, it is lovely. Overall, it stays on the right side of the line, charming, not preachy, with an earnest, not pious heroine, whose chosen survival tactics read, especially to someone of an age at which he or she is acutely aware of children's very real powerlessness, as bravery, not passivity. But it's undoubtedly The Secret Garden that is Hodgson Burnett's masterpiece. The seed of the tale of lonely Mary and Colin, upon whom nature and the gradual gathering of friends slowly work miracles, were sown at Great Maytham Hall, but its full flowering took time. It was published in 1911 to good reviews, most along the simple lines of Outlook magazines. A more delightful mystery for the child mind could not be imagined than that of this long-locked-up, deserted, almost dead garden. Though one did say that The Secret Garden is more than a mere story of children, underlying it there is a deep vein of symbolism. But no great fanfare. When Hodgson Burnett died in 1924, it was, unlike Little Lord Fauntleroy, barely mentioned in her obituaries. But fate, as Sarah Crewe will tell you, is a funny thing. Over the years, Cedric's star has faded, and The Secret Gardens has only risen. It was a book children loved and kept passing on to their own children in turn. Thus it survived until 1949, when a beautiful illustrated edition was published on the 25th anniversary of Hodgson Burnett's death. Buoyed by and resonating with the post-war atmosphere of optimism, and what was a blasted Europe but a giant garden just beginning to put out new shoots again. It was granted a second, more public lease of life, and entered firmly into the cultural consciousness, from where it's frankly unlikely to be dislodged. It's a book that lends itself brilliantly to whatever socio-cultural concerns the age happens to be gripped by. The religiously inclined can see the story of Mary, her character remoulded gently but firmly as she digs and prunes the forgotten garden, as a lament for our lost prelapsarian innocence. Or if you're still shaking your metaphorical fist at the Industrial Revolution, a paean to England's bucolic golden age. Alternatively, if you're a Freudian, I'm sure you can interpret it in all sorts of ways unsuitable for this book. Many have seen the garden as a symbol of motherhood. Mary nurtures it and brings it back to life, and it does the same right back to her. Or perhaps it's a story of exile and homecoming, or the journey through grief. It was written when the bereaved Hodgson Burnett had become interested in Christian Science and various forms of spiritualism that perhaps offered her more comfort than the more inflexible established religious doctrines did. And perhaps the magic that Mary, Colin and Dickon come to believe is at work in the garden is her attempt to depict or grasp hold of them. But I suspect that for most children, the character's faith in the garden's magic reads as it did to me, as a simple appreciation of the wonder of nature. That plants push up through the earth at certain times of year, bloom and fade in unison, without any outward instruction, is, when you first become aware of it, utterly extraordinary. A rose is always a miracle, but you only appreciate that when you're young. You don't need to reach for an external god looking down and orchestrating everything, but you might just reach for a trowel. I actually did. The Secret Garden was one of the few books that inspired me to get off the sofa and do something to try and bring some of the glory of that imagined world into the real one. I hadn't had a doll's house or a knackety-kneed owl or a vortex-friendly garret to try other things out in, but I had a garden. My mother was thrilled. I was doing something. Bending at the waist, moving limbs, using muscles we had all presumed atrophied long ago. She bought me seeds, a little bag of compost, and showed me how to dig it into the soil to prepare the ground for sowing. For a few days, all was well. But the thing about gardening, it turns out, is that it's very slow. Very, very slow. Slow even for a child who's usually so inert was technically a mineral. You have to dig for ages, and then you scatter the seeds, and then instead of just turning the page to find them bursting into bloom, fuck all happens for months. No robins come to visit you, or sex gods. Just your mother and your sister, who are out every 5 minutes to see what you're doing and explain how you're doing it wrong. I began to understand why you needed a secret garden. And you have to do it all out in the fresh air. There was nothing to redeem the experience at all. Mum rejected the idea of hollowing out the apple tree trunk so that we could try roasting eggs with a firmness that was surprising even for her. So I returned to the sofa and the book, in which seasons and events unfolded quickly, pleasingly, and reliably. I would not make the mistake of trying to find contentment in real life again any time soon. E. Nesbit. Next on my canon run came Edith Nesbit. I suspect, given how often I still mix them up, that I thought they were the same person. In fact, they do have many similarities. Like Hodgson Burnett, Nesbit was a sociable, extrovert, unconventional woman. Hodgson Burnett with literary and Eduardo hippie types, while Nesbit favoured the Fabians, whose formal society she and husband Hubert Bland co-founded. They were both wildly imaginative since youth, and prolific producers of potboilers and other hackwork, which here does not mean bad, neither of them ever produced anything unreadable, but simply done to a brief for a particular market not wrenched from the heart, writing at least as much for money as out of natural desire and inclination. Like Hodgson Burnett, Nesbit was less straight-laced than we generally think of late Victorian ladies, let alone our favourite children's writers, and only got away with several extracurricular activities, including a relationship with a lover 10 years younger than herself, Oswald Barron, who inspired the Treasure Seekers and to whom the book is dedicated, because of her wealth and status. She also had to deal with an unsatisfactory husband, though Bland was much worse behaved than Swan or even Stephen. He carried on several affairs, including one very long one with their good friend and housekeeper Alice Hotson. She got pregnant twice and Nesbit adopted both children. She was much happier in her second marriage. In a letter to a friend at the age of 59, she said she finally knew what it was to have a man's whole heart. But this is all faintly distressing. Let us stop letting daylight in upon magic and turn to the books. The Railway Children was the one I revered beyond all else. The comfortable, complacent world of Roberta, Bobby, or Jenny Agutter forever if you saw the film at a formative age, Phyllis and Peter, is suddenly shattered when their father is mysteriously forced to leave them. They must abandon their lovely house in Edwardian suburbia and go and live in a small cottage in the country near a railway line. As this is 1906 and Sunday lifestyle supplements have yet to be invented, this counts as a bitter blow rather than living the dream. The children must learn a new mindset. Jam or butter, dear, not jam and butter. We can't afford that sort of reckless luxury nowadays, counsels their mother, whose superb cheeriness and pluck are the tools with which we truly built the empire, and seek out new friends and entertainments. As luck would have it, it is not only lifestyle supplements, but the health and safety executive, paedophiles and tabloid scaremongering that have yet to be invented, so the children are free to wander up and down the railway line, befriending all the people they come across. These include Bernard Cribbins, Perks, sorry, that film really did get to me, the station master, and the old gentleman, a regular commuter on the 9:15 a.m. down train. When Bobby, the eldest of the children, eventually discovers their father left them because he was falsely accused of selling state secrets to the Russians and sent to prison, it is the old gentleman she asks for help, and who eventually succeeds in proving Mr. Railway Children's innocence. The arrival of the vindicated Mr. R.C. at the railway station has been made famous by the film. Jenny Agutter's cry of, "Daddy, oh my daddy," is still capable, nearly 40 years on, of pulverizing all hearts within a 3-mile radius. But the ending of the book, a version of which is used in the film but you are still sobbing too hard to appreciate it, is sweeter still. Bobby leads him back to the house and tells him to, "Come in, come in," and the narrator turns the reader, with exquisite Edwardian politeness, gently but firmly away. He goes in, and the door is shut. I think we will not open the door or follow him. I think that just now we are not wanted there. I think it will be best for us to go quickly and quietly away. At the end of the field, among the thin gold spikes of grass and the harebells and gypsy roses and St. John's wort, we may just take one last look over our shoulders, at the White House where neither we or anyone else is wanted now. I had long been banned from reading books at mealtimes. At breakfast I would hungrily read and reread the cornflake packet instead. But because I was now permanently immersed in a book at all other times and had effectively withdrawn from family life and all other sorts, but it was family with which she was mainly concerned, Mum had issued a decree. I could only do it downstairs. I was to be within the sphere of family activity, even if not part of it. Which meant, in effect, that I could only read in the sitting room, because that was the only place, the clue was in the name, that you could sit. Though even there, not if the sofa cushions had recently been bumfled. You had to give it an hour or two until the bloom was off the recently plumped rose. I'd like to say I protested, but I'd met my mother before and knew it would just be a waste of valuable reading time. So I took up near-permanent residence on the sofa, moving to the armchair by the window at bumfling times, and on the odd occasions when the sofa was fully occupied by people wanting to watch telly. It didn't really matter. At that age, once I was reading, my concentration was total, my immersion in the book complete. A few sentences was all it took for the world to fade away and fiction to assume reality. Short of my sister dragging me off by the hair to play snap or hide-and-seek with her every so often, I was as happily isolated as I would have been up in my room, but my mother's sense of decorum was satisfied. But I must have escaped the sitting room occasionally, because I remember reading that final paragraph of The Railway Children for the first time up in my room, lying on my bed in front of the window one late afternoon, tilting the book to catch the last of the light as the sun went down. It was the perfect setting for a perfect last page. I went downstairs in a haze of happiness, probably to be shouted at for absenting myself without filling in the relevant permission slips, but it was totally worth it. Despite my ongoing disagreement in this matter with Mum, I identified keenly with Bobby, the ceaselessly vigilant and responsible older sister, because I felt very much that of my mother's two offspring, I would definitely be her chosen confidant at a time of familial distress. I had just got glasses and felt they gave me an air of gravitas with which my sister's ability, fully developed even at the age of six, to identify, dissect, and solve any practical physical or emotional problem within 30 seconds simply could not compete. Yes, were our father to be wrongly accused of espionage and national treachery, she would come to me. I would tell her to let him serve his time. As a fellow introvert, I could imagine nothing nicer than a stretch of solitary confinement somewhere with three guaranteed and silent meals a day, and she would go away comforted, and I would be her favourite. Dad's too, when he found out how well I had arranged things for him. I could make a go of genteel poverty and manage without buns for every tea as long as I was guaranteed a happy ending before the deprivation became too unmanageable. It was all very satisfying. The story of the treasure seekers did not please me half as much, even though it was set just down the road in Lewisham. I read it, liked it, but not enough even to pursue the family through the two sequels, an admission that pains me greatly to make, as it is so clear to me now that from almost its opening line, the volume of the Bastables' adventures is, as well as being formally innovative, as the first time such a book had been written in the first person, a comic masterpiece. "There are some things I must tell you before I begin to tell about the treasure-seeking," says the narrator, soon revealed as Oswald, despite his attempts at omniscient neutrality. "Because I have read books myself, and I know how beastly it is when a story begins, 'Alas,' said Hildegarde with a deep sigh, 'we must look this last on our ancestral home,' and then someone else says something, and you don't know for ages and ages where the home is or who Hildegarde is, or anything about it." It's Teddy Robinson and Plop all over again. At the time, I thought Oswald was a bumptious fool. And to be honest, I would still love to read a book that opens with Hildegarde looking her last on the ancestral home. But now the whole thing has me hysterical, as well as in awe of Nesbitt's deftness in keeping the comedy rolling while shooting it through with shafts of sadness. "Our mother is dead," says the narrator in that same opening paragraph, "and if you think we don't care because I don't tell you very much about her, you only show that you don't know very much about people at all." Wonderful. Twain Coolidge Montgomery. Then I took a little break from my native land's golden age and moved temporarily back to America, courtesy of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, that glorious jumble of scrapes and japes that were apparently naturally a boy's lot if he were able to bowl round a tiny Missouri town on the banks of the Mississippi in the middle of the 19th century. Tom explored caves, outwitted everyone from sheriffs to Sunday school teachers, and had as his best friend the only boy in St. Petersburg with greater liberty than he, Huckleberry Finn, the motherless son of the town drunk. The boy's audacity left me breathless. Daring enough to slip out at night to try a new cure for warts, involving moonlight and a dead cat, but to discover that you were presumed dead and keep quiet thereafter so that you could attend your own funeral. Well, that took my breath away for longer even than the threats issued by the murderous Injun Joe. Alongside that was the touching evolution of Tom's conscience and the glory of Twain's wit and prose more limpid than the streams forever tempting Tom astray. I had never met an author who delivered so many revelations so accessibly. So accessibly, in fact, that they didn't even feel like revelations. They simply felt like things I had always known, hovering about on the edge of my consciousness, until this kind man took the trouble to resolve them for me into words. The most interesting, and famous one, perhaps, came in the very first chapter, when Tom, by pretending that it's fun, persuades his friends to pay him for the privilege of painting the fence Tom has been told by his long-suffering Aunt Polly to whitewash as a punishment for stealing jam from the pantry. He had discovered a great law of human action without knowing it, namely that in order to make a man or boy covet a thing, it is only necessary to make that thing difficult to attain. If he had been a great and wise philosopher like the writer of this book, he would now have comprehended that work consists of whatever a body is obliged to do, and that play consists of whatever a body is not obliged to do. It was a book both funny and informative. I hugged it hard to my breast until it was displaced by another cornerstone of American children's literature, Susan M. Coolidge's 1872 classic What Katie Did. Historically speaking, What Katie Did followed in the wake of Alcott's Little Women and was possibly suggested to Sarah Wolseley, Coolidge was a pen name, by the editor of Little Women himself, Thomas Niles, to capitalize on the newly forged appetite for lively, realistic girls and their exploits. The freckled tomboy in petticoats and heavy boots on the cover piqued my sister's interest, and it became one of the three books she read as a child. The other two were the BBC Micro Computer Guide and a Haynes Car Manual. It should have come as no surprise, perhaps, that when she reached the end of Coolidge's tale, she hurled it across the room, shouting, "Katie did nothing!" before stalking off to finish the kit car she was coding an automated build for behind the sofa. She had a point, in a way. Katie is the eldest but most rambunctious of the Carr siblings when the story begins. After a few chapters of delightful adventures and mischief-making, she decides to play on the new swing Papa's put up in the barn, even though this has been expressly forbidden by Aunt Izzy, who has looked after them all since their fond Mama died. Katie swings high. Too high. Astute reader spots metaphor. The swing breaks, and Katie lands in a crumpled heap, injuring her back so badly it is understood she will never walk again. Confined to bed, Katie rages impotently against fate, until one day, the similarly afflicted cousin Helen, the question of whether this is a coincidence too far even by the forgiving standards of 19th-century children's fiction, or whether paraplegic women were in fact a common feature of shabby genteel Connecticut families in the 1870s, strikes me only now, comes to visit her. By quiet example, she shows the shamefully resentful Katie how she can transmute suffering into feminine grace, patience, and understanding. Over the succeeding months and years, Katie learns to accept her lot and gradually transforms herself into a good girl, becoming the loving centre of the family, the wise, gentle, self-abnegating woman to whom all turn for comfort, advice, and a great deal of hair-stroking. And then, one day, she learns to walk again. Hurrah! After the first few chapters, then, it is, as my sister indirectly pointed out, not so much what Katie did, but what process of inner transformation she underwent. Naturally, some of the ideals held up to Katie have dated. The cultivation of womanly passivity is now no more recommended than is the confinement of those with disabilities to a single room upstairs. Likewise, the idea that disabilities will be lifted from you if you behave well enough is outmoded, and something Jacqueline Wilson was particularly careful to reject when she published a contemporary rewrite of the story a few years ago. But the idea that good can come of suffering intrigued me, and sowed a useful attitudinal seed for later life, and the advent of maths homework that required you to do more than sort apples into groups of five. Whether it's other lessons about the feminine virtues of choking down your inner torments and subjugating your every desire to the whim of God are quite so helpful to readers, I doubt. My sister, incidentally, now programs computers for a living and makes a fortune. She has no understanding of the human condition, but it turns out that this matters far less than you were ever promised. She gives me money for books. So the world turns. I was reading so much and so quickly by this point that it was only if a volume triggered a truly obsessive number of rereads that my dad's attention would be caught. So it was with Katie, and soon that God Amongst Men supplied two sequels, which followed the now ambulant heroine on adventures further afield. What Katie Did at School sends her and Clover off to boarding school in New Hampshire, where they make firm friends with lively, plucky Rose Red, politely distance themselves from their awful cousin Lily, and gradually thaw the icy demeanour of one of the mistresses with their warm, unaffected Midwestern ways and good hearts. The sequel to the sequel, What Katie Did Next, is the tale of her year's tour of Europe as a companion to her father's patient, Mrs. Ash. I, having no urge to travel myself, didn't like this one as much, but I was happy for Katie, and I did enjoy seeing London through the eyes of a 19th-century American. She is particularly impressed with Westminster Abbey, and my sense of time and scale warped with hers, as we gaze together at its dim, rich antiquity with eyes fresh from the world which still calls itself new. It was a tiny illustration, though as neat a one as you could hope to find, of reading's limitless power to expand and transport you through history, space, and in and out of others' consciousness, and I sighed with satisfaction. Soon after that, handsome young naval officer Lieutenant Worthington arrives, and the book lost a great deal of its hold for me as Katie fell in love. Nevertheless, I persevered to the end, noting in a detached way that if you had to fall in love, their stiff, unsentimental method was probably the way to do it. One mention of it being very nice if the lieutenant were to escort them to Genoa, one off-screen conversation before she heads back to Connecticut, and a single telltale blush when Clover mentions that brother of Mrs. Ash once she's home, and they were done. But overall, what Katie did next definitely took the bronze. What Katie did, the silver, and school, the gold. A little after that, I found on the back flap of a hardback edition of What Katie Did in the library mention of another sequel, Clover. I ran to the librarian to beg her to track down a copy. But she had never heard of it, it wasn't on the system anywhere, and there my quest, pre-internet children, ended. We were all undemocratically at the mercy of institutional caprice and unreliable gatekeepers in a way that hardly exists now. However, a few years ago, both Clover and the final, even more thoroughly forgotten book in the series, In the High Valley, were republished. The good news is that I now have the full set. The bad news is that Clover and In the High Valley went unpublished for decades for a reason. They are not a patch on Katie 1, 2 or 3, but I still think they are happy to be all together again. Somehow, somewhere, I can only think there must have been a biographical or autobiographical gobbit or two about the author in my copy of Tom Sawyer, chosen to encourage us to pick up other books, I read Twain's assertion that the eponymous heroine of Anne of Green Gables was the dearest and most lovable child in fiction since the immortal Alice. I tracked down a copy at the library and read it eagerly, only to discover that my idol had steered me wrong. Anne Shirley made me sick as a dog. At first she had my sympathy. She was an orphan, and while I was prepared to hope that they arranged things slightly better in Canada, I knew from Mandy, Bunty and Sarah Crewe that this was a grim lot to be handed in life. But this sympathy rapidly wore off. Relentlessly cheery was Anne Shirley, relentlessly talkative, relentlessly uplifted by the sight of apple and cherry blossom, relentlessly enthusiastic about poetry and puff sleeves. I returned my copy to the library after an unprecedented single reading and went to tap Grandma for whatever medication she had in her capacious handbag for treating childhood nausea. We must reach for another Mark Twain quotation. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. I had come to the book too young. When I picked it up again a few years later, I too was astonished at how much it had improved, and shortly thereafter secretly devastated by the fact that not only could I be an idiot in all matters sporting, artistic and practical, I could also be so when it came to reading too. On rereading then, I learned that Anne Shirley is indeed a dear and most lovable child. Who could not, after all, adore anyone who insists that her name be spelled with the E? So much more distinguished. If you'll only call me Anne with an E, I shall try to reconcile myself to not being called Cordelia. However, could I have not? She is not twee and Pollyanna-ish. It suddenly occurs to me that I should almost certainly reread Pollyanna too. But a doughty survivor of a harsh upbringing who has refused to let circumstances crush her spirit. She arrives at Marilla and Matthew Cuthbert's farm in Avonlea with the odds stacked against her. Orphaned, unwanted, they're expecting a boy. And her greatest and most lamented trial, red-haired and freckled. She proceeds through her odd way of seeing things, through her patently honest love of beauty, and endearing attempts to master her various jealousies and yearnings, to win over the Cuthberts, their neighbours, and millions of readers who have met her over the years since the book was first published. When I settle down with it these days, it's the gradual softening of Marilla that seems to me the true miracle of the book, but this only reminds me again of the great truth that you are never too young to start rereading. As my cornflake packet dependency attests, by this point reading had evolved from a simple pleasure to an actual need. It wasn't just my preferred activity any longer, but an addiction, albeit of the most benign and valuable kind. It was almost physically painful to be kept from it. Every other activity was an interruption, a depredation on time that could be better spent. Birthday parties and going for tea at people's houses was always awful. School was a necessity, playing with my sister was okay, and television had its moments. Not many, there were only 3 channels and Mum naturally had entire charge over what we watched and when. But I was always just happiest reading. Dad understood entirely. Mum didn't, quite, but rolled her eyes and tried to accept that there were some things even she couldn't change, and her child's constitutional makeup was one of them. I'm not saying she wouldn't have dived into my DNA and started replumbing my double helix if technology had allowed, but as things stood, it was one of the few things in life she had to simply grit her teeth and bear. She would wear those teeth down to